Great. Well, we're going to look at this topic. Is there a God? We've got this new series that we're doing, asking life's big questions. And you might think some of these questions will be obvious to you. You might think it's strange for us to be thinking about some of these things on a Sunday evening. But what I want to reassure you and to encourage you is that as we start this series, it will be good for all of us to look at these questions. And as Christians, sometimes I worry that we can often run away from these tough questions, or that we can sometimes even belittle those who have these questions because it's so obvious to us. But it's healthy for us to think about these things too. If we believe these things to be true and we stake our whole lives upon them, then it's good, isn't it, for us to consider why? Because our faith is not a blind faith, is it? Mark Twain, the American author who wrote Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, he was very witty. And if you look up Mark Twain quotes, you'll be there for hours. He says lots of very clever things, but he was very skeptical about religion. And this is what he said about faith. He said, "Faith is believing in what you know ain't so. Faith is believing in what you know ain't so." But what I would like us to see this evening and over the coming weeks is that far from being a blind, optimistic faith and a fairy tale for us to cling to when we are finding this world too difficult, is that Christianity stands up to reason. It stands up to investigation and to logic. So over the coming weeks, it will be good for all of us to hear how the Christian faith deals with its biggest questions, with its biggest objections. But where do we start such a series? Well, there's no better place for us to start with the biggest question of all. Is there a God? This is the single most important question there is. The question of whether there's a God isn't a debate that you can have with your friends in the same way as you can argue over whether you should have pineapple on a pizza or whether Sean Connery was, in fact, the best James Bond. No, this is a serious matter of debate, which exceeds everything else, even more serious than who you thought should have won the American election or whether Brexit should be happening. Because as important as those outcomes are, they don't impact everything. Although it may feel when you're discussing those things, I hope pineapple on pizza doesn't make you this passionately angry. But when you are arguing your case, the outcome of an election or a referendum, they can only affect some aspects of your life, but not all. However, whether there is a God changes everything. Whether there is a God changes absolutely every aspect. Why? And this is what I want us to see today, is because there are consequences and there are implications for our beliefs. What do I mean by that? Well, if you say there is no God, then it impacts a whole number of issues in which you care deeply about. And what we like to do as humans is we like to compartmentalize, and we like to say, well, I want to believe in this part, but I don't want to believe in this part. And what I want you to see tonight is that there is a consistency that is needed. If we believe one thing, then this must be the case. Or if we believe this thing, then this must be the case. And if you don't believe in a God, then there are implications to that. You have to consider why you exist and who the people you love are to you. And is there even a case for morality? If you do believe in a God, then surely it is vitally important for you to know who he is. And we'll look into those things this evening. And maybe 20 years ago, we wouldn't have been having this debate in the same way. Atheism and agnosticism is growing in the UK. In 1998, there was a survey, and 1 in 10 people said that they didn't believe in a God. And they did the same survey last year, and it was as high as 1 in 4. So it's growing. And I wonder where you fit in with those numbers. But why do people believe in a God? Why? Well, you travel to any part of the world in any period of time, and you will see that people look to a God figure. And you can see maybe, even if you are an atheist tonight, that you can see how in early civilization, how a god figure would be thought up by people. They would think maybe in an agricultural society, sometimes it rains and we get crops as a result, and sometimes there are droughts and we get nothing. So there must be a god of the harvest who can be appeased by rain dances and sacrifices. Or if you were a sailor in times gone by, you've maybe thought there was a god of the sea that would could be appeased before long journeys. So you better get on his right side. But the God of the Bible is so radically different to the human mind. We couldn't even conceive it with our own minds. He's not some big vending machine in the sky that we, or someone that needs to be appeased for us to have good fortune. No, the Bible talks about a God of love who didn't create the world through fighting another God and it kind of exploding into existence. But this is the God who powerfully spoke the world into existence by his word, a God who is patient and is perfect and is merciful. And instead of killing those who rebel against him, he takes the form of a man and dies on their behalf. You just couldn't make such a thing that was so wonderful up. And every Christian listening tonight that knows God for themselves has, they would tell you that this is the best thing that has ever happened to them. But obviously there are other people who don't believe in God. And that's the way we're going to do this evening. We're going to look at the four main objections, which I think there are and that people have against there being a God. And I think there are more obviously out there, but these cover the main things. And then we're going to look at how the Bible answers those objections. Right. Firstly, there's no evidence, people say. You can't prove God scientifically. You might say, I'm a reasonable person. I want my life based on science and factual evidence. I stick to what I know to be true, things that I have certain proof for. I know that the earth orbits the sun. I know that water boils at 100 degrees. I know that tadpoles turn into frogs and so on and so forth. Why? Because I can see those things with my own eyes. Scientists have proven it. They've tested these things and we can repeatedly observe these and trust in the facts. And you can't do that with God. I can see why in the olden days, when we weren't well educated, but in 2020, there is no reasonable explanation for there being a big man in the sky that created everything. It seems pretty crazy to me. In 2005, a physicist called Bobby Henderson wrote to the Kansas Board of Education. He was angry that they were proposing to teach a biblical view of creation in their science lessons in schools. And he said, this is preposterous. He said, the argument supporting God, a God who created the universe with intelligent design, is just as likely as being created by a flying spaghetti monster. So that's what he did. I'm not sure if you remember this. It was in the news, but he created this religion called the Religion of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, FSM. His letter to the Board of Education received lots of attention and lots of support. And he was just saying, if other religions can claim crazy, weird things, then why not me? And it's still going to this day. It's sometimes called Pastafarianism as well. And one of their branches in Germany has their own kind of communion services with noodles and beer instead of bread and wine. And if you're in a number of countries, I think New Zealand is one of them, you can have a flying spaghetti monster minister officiate your wedding. And this man said, you've got ridiculous religion with a talking snake and a God man who saves the day by coming back to life. And now you eat his body, which is bread, and his blood, which is wine. Why can't I believe in a flying spaghetti monster? Maybe that's how you feel this evening. Maybe you feel there isn't enough evidence for this God. It's about as plausible as a flying spaghetti monster. Maybe that's what camp you are in. Maybe you're not that... you're not willing to ridicule it to that extent, but maybe you want reason and evidence and scientific proof for a God. Maybe that's where you are. Secondly, I think the objection that people have We'll go through the objections and then we'll go through the responses. That's the order we'll do it in. A second objection that people have against God is that religious people are bad people. How can I possibly believe in a God when the people that follow him are so awful? They claim to be good people and they're just as bad, if not worse, than other people. Surely they're just hypocrites. There is a quote attributed to Gandhi. I'm not sure if he actually said it, but he said, I like your Christ, but I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ. It's a good quote, isn't it? It's a good question. If all these religious people claim to know the way, to know the meaning of life, how come they're such bad people? Churches who say love and unity are the most important things, but they split over the colour of the carpet. You've got church leaders who abuse their power and cover it up. You've got those who make money from the very poorest people because you say that God will bless them if they give lots of money. Or you think of back in history over the Crusades, people going to war for the sake of their gods, or the Spanish conquistadors who traveled the world forcing those they met in South America and other places to become Christians, or they would be killed. Or you think of in other religions, those who kill themselves and others so that they would get to heaven. Surely a world without God or religion would solve this. John Lennon famously sang, didn't he, in his famous song, Imagine. Imagine if there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us, only sky. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. It sounds better than anything religion offers, surely. Maybe that's where you are this evening. Or maybe thirdly, you think, why believe in a God when I can do whatever I want without people judging me? Christians are so judgmental. Why would I want to live that life? Or maybe you think, I don't need God to be a good person. Religion is just a set of rules. It's restrictive. It's boring. This God guy seems like a killjoy. I don't need a holy book or a list of commandments to tell me what to do because I know what I should do. These commandments seem over the top, telling me what to do on a Sunday and telling me how to act with my parents and things like that. Why can't I just get on with my life? Maybe you can relate to something that the actress Katharine Hepburn said. She said, I'm an atheist and that's it. I believe there's nothing we can know except that we should be kind to each other and do what we can for each other. Maybe that's something you live by as well. I don't need God to be a good person. I respect others. I'm polite. I tip generously when I go to a restaurant. I give nice gifts at Christmas. I don't buy any plastic bags. I volunteer. I donate blood. I'm a considerate neighbor. I hold the door open even when they're more than 5 meters away. I cover shifts for my colleagues. I don't litter. I sign petitions. I don't eat meat on Mondays. I not only speak to the charity workers on Queen Street, I give them money. I don't need God in my life to show me how to be a good person. I am a good person. Maybe that's where you are this evening. Well, fourthly, the last objection I want to look at is the problem of evil. Look around at all the problems of the world. How can a God exist when there are so many horrible things going on? This is one of the oldest objections to that people have against there being a God. And the book of Job in the Bible is all about this. A man who is wealthy and is popular and is doing well in life loses everything and suffers greatly. Where is God in all of this? Is there a God in all of this? How can you, maybe you've asked this, how can you look at the state of this planet on any given day with all of its sadness and all of its bad people, and how can a God exist, let alone be in control, and allow this to happen? And the two options raised by this argument are this. Either God is not able to stop all these bad things going on, which makes him powerless and therefore not God. Or the other option is that he sees everything and is capable of stopping it, but chooses not to. So he's not good. So how can a God allow wars and pandemics and fraud and theft and corruption and heartbreak and cancer and lying and tornadoes and climate change and all these things. How does Christianity, how do Christians live with themselves knowing that their God has got this messed up world for us? There's lots to consider there, isn't there? Those four objections are four big, they need four big answers, because those aren't questions that we can just brush under the carpet, because we're human, aren't we? And we need to think these things through. And I would say those are the main objections, and I'm sure there's people have others, but those are the main four. So what do the Christian, what does the Christian faith have to say in response? Let's look at that now. Well, the first objection we looked at was there's no evidence. You can't prove it scientifically. And it was Stephen Hawking who said, there is a fundamental difference between religion, which is based on authority and science. There is a fundamental difference between religion, which is based on authority, and science, which is based on observation and reason. Science wins because it works. He was right, you may think. Science has done away with God. Surely there can't be people nowadays who are reasonable and who live in a scientifically sound manner and also believe in God. The two are maybe completely at odds with each other, you may think. And yet, over the last 100 years, 60% of the Nobel Prize winners for physics have believed in God. That's a good amount of them. And yes, that means 40% of them didn't. But you see, the two are clearly not incompatible. Even these scientists working at a very high level believe in a God. There are people working at the highest level who trust and know that there is a God. And what I want to argue is that even the most scientifically driven person doesn't live a life which purely is purely based on science. Human life, as we know it, doesn't work like that. Why? Well, because if you live like that, then you start seeing things through a cold and clinical lens. There's a physicist in America called Sean Carroll, and he wrote a book about what it means to be human. And this is what he said. He said, "We are collections of vibrating quantum fields held together in persistent patterns by feeding off ambient free energy according to the impersonal and uncaring laws of nature." Now, let me take you back to 4 weeks ago yesterday in the Heath Hospital, and my son, my first son, was born. And the first thing I did as he was born, I held him in my arms and I turned to my dear wife, who'd just been through an ordeal, and I said to Kat, "Kat, look at this collection of vibrating quantum fields." And she said, "He reminds me of you. I think it's the way he holds together in persistent patterns by feeding off ambient free energy according to the impersonal and uncaring laws of nature." Funnily enough, we'd said similar things in our wedding vows. My brother who officiated the wedding said, "Dalan, do you take this vibrating quantum field?" And so on. You get my point. We don't live in this impersonal, cold, scientific way. No one lives to that level of scientific accuracy. And if you read on in Carroll's book, he himself contradicts himself. He said in the book, he says, "We are also human beings who make choices and care about what happens to ourselves and others." You see, it's difficult to see how you can juggle both of those very different sorts of ideas. And yet, like I said before, you compartmentalize, and it's actually a very popular way of thinking today. We often talk about cold, hard facts, about experimentation and evidence and spreadsheets and two words that you hear so often today, the science. And we want to affirm what we know through biology and history and psychology and everything. We want evidence for things. And yet the lives we live are so much more than that. You can't put everything through a lab. You can't. You can't put everything in a test tube. The relationship between a child and a parent, the rich love between a man and his wife over years of marriage, friendship, selfless acts of service. One of those accounts that you hear time and time again of maybe a terrorist attack where someone gives up their life for a complete stranger. Or how we can be outraged at something on the news when it doesn't come close to affecting us. Our uniquely human feelings of sacrificial love, of empathy, of hope, and even the desire to know why we're here, they all fly in the face of a godless naturalistic universe where it's merely the survival of the fittest and our only real aim is to pass on our DNA before we die, where we act on a purely instinctive basis or whether we've got learned morals. Well, think about this. It's not even just those things, those feelings that we have. Even things like who won the gold medal at the last Olympics or what you ate on this day last year or whether Julius Caesar existed. Those things happened, but they can't be proven through a scientifically tested way. They can be maybe proven by other means, but it doesn't mean that those things don't exist or they never happened. So rather than judging whether we can scientifically prove God, we need to see ourselves less as scientists. We need to see ourselves more as jurors. You see, a court case cannot be provided and proven by science. Yes, there's forensic evidence, but you cannot have the things that you look for in a science test. You cannot have precision, repeatability, and reproducibility to work out a murder, for example. You can't ask the person in the coffin to get up so that you can try and see it all over again and test it again. No, in a court case, it involves looking at evidence. For and against, there's a defense and a prosecution, and you hear the reasoning and whether it was plausible, and then you weigh up whether what you have heard makes sense in light of the evidence that you've seen as well. And Christianity is the same. Yes, there is some scientific evidence for a God, but not in a handy way which you can dip in a piece of litmus paper, and when it turns red, you know there's a God, and blue, you know there isn't a God. We look at science, we look at historical evidence, we look at archaeology. We read eyewitness accounts. We see if the Bible is consistent with itself, and we'll look at that a bit more next week. We look at the evidence of lives that have been changed by what they've experienced. We look at the world around us. You see, if we were only born in order to eat, to try and find a mate so that we can pass on our genes into our offspring before we die, then why are we as humans constantly looking for a reason for existing? A horse or a dolphin or a hedgehog, they're not gathering today to talk about these things. They don't think like this. Why do we feel as if there is something more in life? C.S. Lewis, the writer, once said this. He wrote a book called Mere Christianity, which I would really recommend people read. It's very helpful. But he said this in that book. Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exist. A baby feels hunger. Well, there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim because there's such a thing as water. People feel sexual desire. Well, there's such a thing as sex. And if I find myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it and to suggest the real thing. What he's saying is that there's a reason why we're all looking for something more, because there is something more. It's a wonderful quote, and it really gets us thinking, doesn't it? There's more to life than the science, and it's not just Christians who live in this way. I think we all do. Secondly, what about the fact that Christians are bad people and religious people are bad people? Well, I want you to picture with me. Imagine Queen were my favorite band. They're not, but imagine if they were. And I said I had tickets to see a Queen tribute act. And you had never listened to Queen before, but I've told you how much I like them. I say to them, they've got loads of amazing songs and they're great musicians. And I'm sure this tribute band will be the same. And we get to the venue, imagine, we could even go to a venue, those are the days. Imagine we get to the venue and it's the worst night ever. The drummer has forgotten his kit, so he's just clanging cymbals together. The guitarist has only got one string, and the bassist had a change of heart last minute and thought the songs would sound better with a recorder, and the singer is tone deaf. And your conclusion from that evening would be they're rubbish. What if your conclusion from that evening would be that Queen are a bad band and weren't worth listening to? No, it would be that the tribute band are rubbish. Now, I hope this goes a little way of illustrating that it's not good for us to always make decisions about God and who he is on what his followers are like. Christians have done awful things in history. That's a fact. If you want to delve into history books, you will find Christians who have done awful things. And you don't even have to look at history to do that. You can look at the news. Firstly, I want to say, not everyone who claims to be a Christian is a Christian. Some people do awful things and claim they're doing it for God, but that doesn't mean they're actually Christians. That's my first thing. Secondly, Christians do very much do awful things sometimes. They say the wrong thing, they do the wrong thing, they hurt people, and they let people down and they take advantage. And maybe you've been hurt by Christians. Maybe that's your reasoning for not wanting to trust in God. I'm sorry if that has happened to you. I'm really sorry. But there shouldn't be anyone claiming to be a perfect Christian. Christian people aren't perfect people. I hope that if you've ever been in church or met a Christian and spent time with Christians, they don't give off the impression that they think they are perfect. So instead of coming to the conclusion that there can't be a God because of what Christians are like, instead, why not look at the one who is the source, the perfect one? Jesus said, and when someone called him good, he said, "Why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone." In that statement, he was saying two things. He was saying, "I'm good and I'm God." You see, God made himself known to us in a number of ways through the world. He made himself known through creation, through speaking through prophets and through the writings of the Bible. But he finally did it through Jesus Christ. He showed what he was really like by being born and living in this world and living perfectly. And we often think about that at Christmas time. And this Jesus, he was kind and he was generous and he was patient and he was truthful and he was sincere. The opposite of all the things that we just listed about people that we don't like. And yet the religious people of the day, the people that were most respected for how religious they were, they weren't happy with him. They were jealous of him. And they didn't like how bad he made them look. When they put him on trial, before he was killed, we read this in the Bible. Pilate then called together, Pilate was one of the Roman leaders of the day, then called together the chief priests, the leaders and the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who is perverting the people. And here I've examined him in your presence and have not found this man guilty of any of the charges against him. Neither is Herod, another leader of the time, for he sent him back to us. Indeed, this man has done nothing to deserve death." Even the most corrupt leaders of the day, who would have loved to have found some dirt on Jesus, some flaw, some skeleton in the closet, they couldn't find anything. And that's what the Christian faith is about. It's about Christ. It's not about what Christians do. Although when Christ comes into our lives, our actions should reflect him, but it's about his record. It's not about trying to be a good person, because we know we'll all fail at that. It's about putting our trust in the one good person to have ever lived and who died for us, Jesus Christ. A death he never deserved, a death that we deserved. So stop looking to Christians, look to Christ. Third objection, still with me. Why believe in a God when I can do whatever I want without people judging me? I don't need God to be a good person. That was the third objection. I think this is why most people don't want to believe in a God. It's not the intellectual thing. It's the fact that you want to live life the way you want. And we all are like that. We all hate authority and we all want to do exactly what we want. I want to drink what I want. I want to sleep with who I want. I want to spend my money how I want. I want to spend my time how I want. And God doesn't allow me to do that. My response then would be not to believe in him. My response to that thinking is to think for a second about, just because not wanting to believe in something to be true doesn't mean it's not true. And often the things that we give priority and the things that we say are important and the things that we chase after, do they ever bring the satisfaction that they promise? Ultimately, even the most accomplished life still lacks. We always want more. You see this in a lottery winner. Now, the amount of money you win in a lottery nowadays is huge. You can win over £100 million. And they think having it all will bring them the happiness that they are after. It takes a matter of months, maybe years, for them to realize that it wasn't the problem. Money wasn't the problem. It's inside of us. I would argue that it's only Jesus Christ that can satisfy fully. Jesus said this to a woman who had been married 5 times. She'd been looking for her satisfaction in her relationships. And Jesus said this to her. He said, everyone who drinks this water, he was pointing at a well, will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life. You see, we're all thirsting after meaning and satisfaction in life. Only Jesus can provide it. But Dylan, you might say, I don't want to be rich or successful. I just want to be nice. I just want to be good. I don't need God to do that, surely. And you can be an atheist who does nice things and good things. There are atheists out there who have done lots of good for people. I'm not arguing that. But and we've said before that Christians have done some awful things. But it's not about comparing people to people. Let me try and show you. If I were to have a line on this side of the screen and going all the way to this side of the screen, and we had Hitler on one end and Jesus at the opposite end. Now, I want you to imagine the most wonderful human you can think of. This is a made-up person. This person has adopted orphan children. They've found the cure for cancer on their day off. And they've been wonderful to their neighbors. They've never lost their temper. They're just beautiful. Such a person doesn't exist. But if they did, where would they go on the line? Well, they would go on Hitler's end. Because that's how far we are from Jesus. Jesus never did anything wrong. Because this person, even how wonderful all those actions would be, there wouldn't be an hour in the day where they didn't go wrong at some point. Jesus was perfect and holy and blameless to the nth degree. There was nothing on him. And that is the standard that we have to compare ourselves to. What the Bible says is that we're so, so far from the standard of perfection which God has set, that even our best ever day is not acceptable to God. We cannot keep the laws of the Bible. We cannot live how God wants us to. Even if you tried your very, very best after this meeting finishes for an hour, try not to make any mistakes, you would mess up pretty quickly. I certainly would. So what hope, you're thinking? This guy is just telling me how awful I am. Well, the Bible says if we put our trust in Jesus, then he stands in our place. Like a substitute, he says, I'll take your place. And when God looks at us and sees whether we match up to his perfection, rather than seeing the list of things that we have done, he sees Jesus' list, which is nothing. That's why it's such good news. That's why the Bible provides us with such good news. But you say, oh, that's well and good. Science, the actions of Christians and those that are not, that doesn't matter to me. But what about the world around us? That's the last objection I want to look at. How can there be a God when we're surrounded by bad news and bad people? How can a God exist when there are so many horrible things going on? By saying that there is no God, you're not solving the problem. Rather than saying the world is a mess, it's God's fault or God can't be there, you're saying the world is a mess. That's all you're saying. And no Christian would argue against that. The world is a mess. What the Bible has, which an atheist doesn't, is a reason for that. The Christian faith actually provides a reason for the problems of the world. It tells us why. It offers hope when believing in a God just that doesn't, when an atheist just offers a shrug of the shoulders. Let's look at the recent global pandemic as a case study. If we were living in a world without God, then COVID-19 is unfortunate, but not the end of the world. It will mean that our gene pools will be stronger as the weak and the vulnerable will die. There'll be more resources for us that are healthy, and that's good. Survival of the fittest can take place. Random chance. That's great. Richard Dawkins, who is not as popular as he used to be, but was very popular about 10, 15 years ago, said this: the universe that we observe has precisely the properties we would expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. I'd argue one of the reasons why Richard Dawkins and others in the same manner as him have lost their influence on people is because you can't actually live with that mindset, as I mentioned before, with that quantum stuff that I mentioned before. Can't remember what it was. But you can't look at the world and just think, that's just DNA doing its thing. It's just dancing away. We look at nature and biology and viruses and natural disasters, and we see people doing horrible things on the news that makes our blood boil. People doing awful things. And there's an anger within us. Where does that anger come from? That's not an evolved, learned behavior. One Christian thinker said this: my argument, before he was a Christian, he talks about his transition to becoming Christian. He said, my argument against God before I became a Christian was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? You see, there must be some sort of standard, an objective standard to why the world is the way it is. You cannot look at the devastating effects of a global pandemic or war or prejudice or mental health or earthquakes or accidental explosions and think, ah, well, that's the world we live in. Even saying it feels wrong. Because when we see those things and we process tragedy and we grieve for someone who has died, we know something here is not right. And there's a reason why you think that, because it's not right. If you go back to the beginning of the Bible, God made a perfect world. At the very beginning of the Bible, we see the Lord God creates the world from nothing. He creates stars and fish and plants and trees and flowers and all these amazing things. And you read the way in which God creates the world, and he says, it is good, it is good, it is good. And on the sixth day, which is the climax of all his creation, he creates people, man and woman. He creates them to be like him. And the Bible calls this being in God's image. He creates people like him, and he gives them a garden to enjoy and to care for and to work in. And everything is still good. But also, he didn't create robots. He gave them freedom to choose and given them so many things to do, to spend their time doing, to enjoying him, and only one thing not to do, not to eat from a certain tree. He said if they ate from that, then it would result in death. But that's what they did. They rejected God. They took that choice. And that is what the Bible calls sin. Sin is the absence of good. When the Bible talks about sin, it's the absence of God's goodness. So when this Bible here talks about things that are against God, it's the absence of things. So it's lovelessness, lawlessness, unrighteousness, disobedience, godlessness. And since those choices are a choice against the God of life, acting against him results in the opposite of life. It results in death. So death, you see, is unnatural. There's a reason why we cry at funerals, because it's unnatural. It's not supposed to end this way. When Adam and Eve rejected the God of life, they chose death. And in that moment, the image of God found in humanity was ruined. Because of this rebellion, death came into the world in all its different forms, shame, broken relationships, pain, and ultimately death. And nature was affected. That's why there are viruses, diseases, droughts, famines, earthquakes, volcanoes, all these things. That's why there is selfishness, stealing, abuse, bullying, violence, and racism. But that's where the good news of the Bible is. It doesn't just say, oh, there are all these bad things. Deal with it, guys. No, the Bible has that wonderful verse that I read to you at the start. You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, the Bible says, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, though for a good person, someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. We have a God who doesn't just see a suffering world. He is a God who steps into that world and suffered to the point of death. This is why it's so amazing. We can trust him because he knows what it means to go through hard times, to be let down, to be sick, and to be disappointed, and to be betrayed, to be in pain, and even to die. We have a God who knows exactly how we feel because he's felt it himself. And he did it for us. Not because we're special or because we've earned it, but because he loves us, like a parent loves a child. So I think those objections to God, they have their answers. And over the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at more big questions and what the Bible has to say about it. But what I really want us to see is that the Bible stands up to these things. There is, one man said, we have a reasonable faith. And I think it is reasonable. And I hope, and my prayer tonight is if you've never thought that the idea of God, a God could be plausible, then I hope you've seen that there is plausibility. And it's not just the idea of a God, but I want, and everyone here tonight who is part of Emmanuel wants you to see that there is a personal God who would love to get to know you and would love for you to put your trust in him. And we'll find out more about him over the weeks to come.